trousers were grubby. My once long Withywood's green jerkin was spotted and stained and ended raggedly at my hips. My underblouse was grimy at the cuffs, a very convincing beggar. I should go down to the docks and see if any ships were bound to Buck, or indeed anywhere in the six duchies. I wondered how I could ask and what I could do to earn passage on one. The sun was bright and my clothing too warm for the mild day. I moved deeper into the shade and curled up with my back to a stack of wood. I did not mean to fall asleep, but I did. I woke in late afternoon. The shade had travelled away from me, but I had slept until the moving light of the sun on my closed eyes had woken me. I sat up, feeling miserably sick, dizzy, and thirsty. I staggered to my feet and began to walk. My small store of courage was gone. I could not make myself go down to the docks or even explore more of the city. I retreated to the ruins where I had sheltered the night before. In a city full of strangeness, I took comfort from what little I knew. By daylight, the water in the old fountain in the ruined house's garden was greenish, and little black water creatures darted in its depths. But it was water, and I was thirsty. I drank and then bared my body to wash as best I could. I rinsed out my clothes and was surprised at how hard a task that was. Once again, I realized how easy a life I'd led at Withywood's. I thought of the servants who had supplied my every need. I had always been polite to them, but had I ever truly thanked them for all they did? Caution came to mind, and how she had loaned me her lace cuffs. Was she still alive? Did Caution think of me sometimes? I wanted to weep, but did not. Sternly I made my plans as I dipped and scrubbed and wrung out my garments. Dwalia had thought me a boy. It was safer to present myself as a boy. Would a ship going toward the six duchies need a boy? I'd heard tales of ship's boys having wild and wonderful adventures. Some became pirates in the minstrel's songs, or found treasures, or became captains. Tomorrow I would take two of my coins and buy more bread and eat it. I very much liked that part of my plan. Then I must go down to the waterfront and see if any ships were going to the six duchies, and if they would give me passage for work. I pushed away the thought that I was small and looked childish and was not very strong and spoke no Chalcedian. Somehow, I would manage. I had to. I hung my clothing on a broken stone wall to dry and stretched out naked on the sun-warmed stones of a deserted courtyard. My mother's candle was battered, the wax imprinted with lint, and broken in that one place with only the wick holding it together. But it still smelled like her, like home and safety and gentle hands. I fell asleep there in the dappling shade of a half-fallen tree. When I woke a second time, my clothing was mostly dry and the sun was going down. I was hungry again and dreaded the chill night. I had slept so much, but I still felt weary, and I wondered if my journey through the stone pillars had taken more from me than I knew. I crawled deeper under the leaning tree to where the leaves of several falls made a cushion against the stone. I refused to think of spiders and biting things. I curled up small and slept again. Sometime in the night, I lost my courage. My own crying woke me, and once awake, I could not stop the sobs. I stuffed my hand in my mouth to muffle the sounds and wept. I wept for my lost home, for the horses killed in the fire, for Revel dead in his blood on the floor before me. Everything that had happened to me, all that I had seen and had not had time to react to, suddenly flooded my mind. My father had left me for the sake of a blind beggar man, and Perseverance was probably dead. I'd left Shun behind and hoped the best for her. Had she survived and reached Withywood's to tell them what had befallen us? Would anyone ever come after me? I remembered FitzVigilant, his blood red on the white snow. Suddenly, going home seemed impossible. Going home to what? Who would be there? Would they all hate me because the pale folk had come for me? And if I went home, would not Dwalia or others of her kind know where I would flee? Would they come after me again, to burn and kill? I hunched low under my sheltering tree, rocking myself, knowing that there was no one who could protect me.
I'll protect you.
Wolffather's words were less than a whisper. He was only in my mind, only an idea. How could he protect me? What was he, really? Something I imagined from the fragments of my father's writing. I am real, and I am with you. Trust me. I can help you protect yourself. I felt a sudden rush of anger. You didn't protect me before, when they took me. You didn't protect me when Dwalia beat me and dragged me through the pillar. You're a dream, something I imagined because I was so childish and scared. But you can't help me now. No one can help me now. No one except yourself. Be silent! I shouted the words, and then covered my mouth in horror. I needed to hide, not shout at imaginary beings in the night. I scuttled deeper under the tree until I felt a tumble of fallen wall and could go no farther. I made myself small and shut my eyes tight and walled my thoughts in and slept. I woke the next day with my face crusty from my weeping. My head pounded with pain, and I felt nauseous with hunger. It was a long time before I could convince myself to crawl out from the tree's shade. I did not feel well enough to walk down to the markets, so I wandered the ruined area of the city. I caught sight of lizards and snakes basking on the tumbled stones. I thought of eating one, but at my approach they whisked under the stones. Twice I saw other people who seemed to be living in the broken houses. I smelled their cook fires and saw ragged clothing hung to dry. I kept out of their sight. Hunger drove me at last back to the market. I could not find the bread stall I'd patronized the day before. I staggered and limped through the stalls, looking for it, but finally my raging hunger forced me to approach another. A sour-faced woman was cooking pastries stuffed with some savory filling on a griddle. A small metal pot held her cookfire. The pastries sizzled in a wide pan over the flames, and she deftly flipped them with a pronged tool to brown each side. I offered her one coin, and she shook her head. I wandered off behind a stall where I could extract another coin from my knotted shirt. For two coins, she put a pastry on a wide green leaf, folded the leaf around it, secured it with a sliver of wood, and handed it to me. I bowed my thanks, but she ignored that, already looking over my head for her next potential customer. I did not know if the leaf was meant to be eaten or was a napkin. I took a cautious nibble of the edge. It was not unpleasant. I reasoned that a vendor would not wrap food in something poisonous. I found a quiet place behind an unoccupied market stall and sat down to eat. The pastry was not large, just filling my hand. I wanted to eat it slowly. The filling was crumbly and tasted a bit like wet sheep smelled. I didn't care. But after my second bite, I became aware of a boy watching me from the gap between the walls of two stalls. I looked away from him, taking another bite, and when I glanced back, a smaller boy in a dirty striped shirt had joined him. Their hair and their feet and bare legs were dusty, their clothing unkempt. They had the eyes of small, hungry predators. I felt a moment of dizziness as I stared at them. It reminded me of when the beggar at Oaks Bywater had held my hand. I saw events swirling, possibilities. I could not sort them, could not tell good from bad. All I knew for certain was that I must avoid them. As a donkey cart passed between us, I scooted around the corner of the stall and stuffed the rest of my pastry in my mouth, overfilling it, but freeing my hands. I rose and tried to blend in with the passing folk. My clothing made me stand out, so that I drew curious glances. I kept my eyes down and tried not to engage anyone's attention. I glanced back several times, but did not see the boys, yet I was convinced they were following me. If they robbed me of my two remaining coins, I would have nothing. I fought down the panic that thought brought. Don't think like prey. A warning from Wolffather, or simply a thought of my own? I slowed my steps, found a place to crouch beside a refuse cart, and watched the ebb and flow of people. There were others like me in the market, and those young beggars were more skilled at this trade. Three youngsters, two girls and a boy, lingered at a fruit vendor's stall, despite his efforts to shoo them away. Suddenly, all three darted in, each seizing a prize, and then they scattered while the seller shouted and cursed and sent his son chasing after one of them. I saw, too, some sort of city guards. Their orange robes were cut short to their knees, and they wore canvas trousers, light leather tunics, and low boots. They carried short, knobbed staves and wore sheathed swords as they strode past in groups of four. Merchants offered them skewers of meat and rolls of bread and chunks of fish on flatbread as they passed. I wondered if gratitude or fear prompted such generosity, and slipped away from their view as quickly as I could. I made my way eventually to the docks. It was a noisy, busy place. Men were pushing handcarts, teams of horses pulled laden wagons, with some going to the ships and others coming from them. The smells were overwhelming. Tar and rotting seaweed predominated. I hung back, watching and wondering how to tell where a ship was going. I had no desire to be carried even farther from the six duchies. I watched wide-eyed as an apparatus I could not name lifted a net that held several large wooden crates and swung them from the dock to a ship's deck. I saw a young man receive three sharp cracks from a stick across his bared back, even as he was guiding such a swinging cargo down to a deck. I could not tell what he had done wrong or why he had been struck and shrank back, imagining such blows falling on me. I saw no one as small as me working on the docks, though I guessed that several of the boys I saw were my age. They worked shirtless, darting barefoot on the splintery docks, on apparently urgent missions that demanded they run. One boy had an oozing welt down his back. A cart driver shouted at me to get out of his way, and another man did not bother, shoving me aside, shoulders laden with two heavy coils of rope. Daunted, I fled through the market and then up the hill toward the ruins. As I left the market, a young man in a lovely robe, decorated with rosettes of yellow, called to me with a smile. He beckoned me closer, and when I halted at a safe distance, wondering what he wanted of me, he crouched down to my height. He cocked his head and said something softly, persuasive words that I did not understand. He looked kind. His hair was more yellow than mine and cut so that it barely reached his jaw. His earrings were green jade. A man of a good family and wealth, I guessed. "I don't understand," I replied hesitantly in common. His blue eyes narrowed in surprise, and then his smile widened. In a heavy accent, he said, "Pretty new robe. Come, give you food." He eased a step closer to me, and I could smell his perfumed hair. He held out his hand, palm upturned, and waited for me to take it.
"Run, run now."
Wolffather's urgency brooked no hesitation. I gave the smiling man a final glance, a shake of my head, and I darted away. I heard him call after me, and I wondered why I ran. But run I did. He called after me again, but I did not look back.
"Do not go straight to your den. Hide and look back,"
Wolffather cautioned me, and so I did, but saw no one. Later that night, curled under my sheltering tree, I wondered why I had fled.
"Eyes of a predator," Wolffather told me.
"What should I do tomorrow?" I asked him.
"I don't know,"
was his woeful response. I dreamed of home that night, of toasted bread and hot tea in the kitchen. In my dream, I was too small to reach the top of the table, and I could not right the overturned bench. I called to Caution to help me, but when I turned to look for her, she was lying on the floor with blood all over her. I ran from the kitchen screaming, but everywhere folk were dead on the floor. I opened doors to try to hide, but behind each door were the two beggar boys, and beyond them, Dwalia stood, laughing. I woke sobbing in the middle of the night. To my terror, I heard voices, one calling questioningly. I muffled my sobs and tried to breathe silently. I saw a dim light and a lantern passed by in the street outside my broken garden. Two people spoke to each other in Chalcedian. I stayed hidden and wakeful until morning. The morning was half gone before I found the courage to return to the market. I found the bread stall I'd visited the first day, but the young man had been replaced by a woman, and when I showed her my two coins, she gestured me away in disgust. I held them both up again, thinking she had seen only the one, but she hissed a rebuke at me and slapped her hands together threateningly. I retreated, resolved to find food elsewhere, but in that instant I was knocked down by one of the two boys I'd seen the day before. In a flash, the other boy snatched my coins and they both darted away into the market throng. I sat up in the dust, the wind knocked out of me. Then, to my shame, sobs shook me, and I sat in the dirt and covered my eyes and wept. No one cared. The flow of the market went around me as if I were a stone in the current. For a time after my sobbing left me, I sat forlorn. I was so terribly hungry. My shoulder ached, the relentless sun shone on my aching head, and I had no plans left. How could I imagine getting home when I could not think how to get through the day? A man guiding a donkey cart through the market tapped me with his quirt. It was a warning, not a strike, and I quickly scrabbled out of his way. I watched him pass and smeared dust and tears from my face onto my sleeve and looked around the market. The hunger that assailed me now seemed the product of weeks rather than just a day. While I'd had the prospect each day of something to eat, however small, I'd been able to master it. But now it commanded me. I squared my shoulders, wiped my eyes once more, and then walked deliberately away from the bread stall. I moved slowly through the market, studying each stall and vendor. My moral dilemma lasted as long as it took for me to swallow the saliva the smells of the foods triggered. Yesterday, I'd seen how it was done. I had no one to create a diversion for me, and if anyone decided to pursue me, I would be the only rabbit to be run down. My hunger seemed to speed my thought processes. I'd have to choose a stall and a target and an escape route. Then I'd have to wait and hope that something would distract the merchant. I was small and I was fast. I could do this. I had to do this. Hunger such as I felt now could not be borne. I prowled the market, intent on my theft. Nothing small. I did not want to take this chance for a bit of fruit. I needed meat or a loaf of bread or a side of smoked fish. I tried to look without appearing to look, but a small boy lifted a switch threateningly at me when I stared too long at his mother's slabs of red salted fish. I finally found what I sought, a baker's stall, bigger and grander than any other I'd seen. Loaves of rich brown and golden yellow were mounded in baskets on the ground in front of his stall. On the plank before him were the more expensive wares, bread twisted with spices and honey, rich cakes studded with nuts. I'd settle for one of the golden yellow pillows. The stall next to him sold scarves that billowed in the breeze off the sea. Several women were clustered there, their bargaining focused and intense. Across the milling market street, a tinker sold knives. His partner sharpened blades of all sorts on a spinning whetstone powered by a sweating apprentice. The grinding made a shrill sound, and sometimes it spat sparks. I found a backwater of the customer stream and pretended a great fascination with the spinning stone. I let my mouth hang a trifle ajar as if I did not have all my mind. I was sure that with such an expression and my ragged clothes, folk would pay little attention to me. But all the while, I waited for anything in the market that might make the bread vendor look away from his wares and give me a chance to steal my target. As if in answer to my thoughts, I heard distant horns. All glanced in that direction and then went back to their business. The next blast of the horn was closer. People turned again, nudging one another, and finally we saw four white horses decked out in fine harness of black and orange. The guards who rode the horses were just as richly attired, their helms as plumed as their horses' headstalls. They rode toward us, and the clusters of buyers pushed against the stands to get out of their way. As the riders again lifted their horns to their mouths, I saw my chance. All were watching them as I darted in, seized a round golden loaf, and then darted back the way the horsemen had come. So intent had I been on my theft that I had not perceived that behind the horsemen the market street had remained empty, and that the folk who lined the street had dropped to their knees. I ran, skittering out into the empty street as the bread merchant shouted. When I tried to dart back into the kneeling crowd to lose myself among them, people grabbed at me, shouting. Another set of guards was coming on foot, marching in a row of six, with two more rows behind them, and behind them came a woman on a black horse with harness of gold. The kneeling folk were packed as solidly as a wall. I tried to push into them. A man grabbed me with hard hands and pushed me down in the dirt. He growled at me, a command I did not understand. I struggled to rise, and he slapped me sharply on the back of my head. I saw stars and went slack. An instant later, I realized that everyone around me was frozen into stillness. Had he bid me be still? I lay as he had pushed me. The loaf I had stolen was clutched to my chest and chin. The smell of it was dizzying. I did not think. I tucked my head and opened my mouth and bit into it. I lay on my belly in the dusty street and gnawed at the loaf like a mouse, as first the ranks of guards and then the woman on her black horse and then another four ranks of guards passed. No one moved until a second rank of horsemen came. At intervals, they halted and rang brass chimes. Only after they had passed did the nearby merchants and buyers rise to their feet and resume their lives. I waited, chewing busily into my bread, and the moment the chimes rang, I bucked to my feet and tried to run. But the man who had held me down snatched the back of my jerkin and gripped my hair. He shook me and shouted something. The bread merchant came dashing over, snatched the bread out of my hand, and cried out to find it dirty and chewed. I cringed, thinking he would hit me, but instead he began to shout one word over and over. He threw the bread down in anger, and how I longed to snatch it up again. But my captor held me fast. The city guard, that was who he was shouting for, and two came on the run. One smirked and looked at me almost kindly, as if he could not believe he had been summoned for such a small thief. But the other was a businesslike fellow, who seized me by the back of my tunic and all but lifted me off my feet. He began to ask me questions, and the bread man began to shout his side of the story. I shook my head and then gestured at my mouth, trying to convey that I could not speak. I think it was going well, until the kind guardsman leaned close to his fellow, and then suddenly gave me such a pinch that I squeaked. Then it was all over. I was shaken, and when the guardsman who held me lifted his hand to slap me, I burst out in common, "I was hungry, so I stole. What else was I to do? I am so hungry." Then, shaming myself, I burst into tears and pointed at the bread and strained toward it. The man who had caught me first stooped and picked it up and put it into my hands. The breadman attempted to slap it away from me, but the guardsman who still held me swung me out of his reach. Then, to complete my humiliation, he picked me up and perched me on his hip, as if I were a much younger child, and strode off through the market. I gripped the bread in both hands. I could not control my tears or my sobs, but that did not stop me from eating the bread as fast as I could get it down. I had no idea what might happen to me next, but decided that one thing I would be sure of. I would fill my belly with the bread that had gotten me into so much trouble. I was still clutching the last of the crust when my carrier strode up three steps to the door of an unremarkable stone building. He pushed open the door, carried me inside, and then swung me to the floor as his partner followed. An older man in a fancier livery looked up from a table as we came in. His noon meal was spread out before him, and he looked rather annoyed to be interrupted. They spoke about me over my head as I looked around the room. There was a bench down one plain wall. A woman sat on it. Her feet were chained together. At the other end of the bench, a man sat hunched with his face in his hands. He glanced up at me, and his mouth was all blood and one eye was swollen shut. He put his face back in his hands. The guard who had carried me seized me by the shoulder and shook me. I looked up at them. He spoke to me. I shook my head. The man behind the desk spoke to me. I shook my head again. Then, in common, he asked me, "Who are you? Are you lost, child?" At the simple question, I burst into tears again. He looked mildly alarmed. He made shooing motions at the two guards, and they left. As the one went out the door, he looked back at me, almost as if he were concerned for me. But the man at the table was talking again. "Tell me your name. Your parents could pay for what you stole and take you home." Was that even possible? I drew a breath. "My name is B. Farsier. I'm from the Six Duchies. I was stolen from there, and I need to go home." I took a breath and made a wild promise. "My father will pay money to get me back."
"I've no doubt that he will."
The man leaned one elbow on his desk, right next to a little round cheese. I stared at it. He cleared his throat.
"How did you come to be running about on the streets of Chalesed, B. Farsier?"
He made my name one word. I didn't correct him. It didn't matter. If he would listen to me and send word to my father, I knew he would pay money to get me back. Or Nettle would. Surely she would. And so I told him my story, doing my best to leave out the unbelievable parts. I told him of Chalesedians raiding my home and how I'd been carried off. I didn't explain how I'd come to Chalesed, only that I'd slipped away from Kerf and his companions because they had been cruel to me. And now I was here, and I only wanted to go home, and if he would send word to my father, I was sure someone would come and bring money and take me home. He looked a bit puzzled by my stew of a story, but nodded gravely at the end.
"Well, I understand now, perhaps better than you do."
He rang a bell on the corner of his desk. A door opened and a sleepy-looking guardsman came in. He was very young and looked bored.
"Runaway slave, property of someone named Kerf. Take her to the end cell. If no one claims her in 3 days, take her to the auction. Price of a loaf of pollen bread is owed to Searching the Baker. Make a note that this curf must either pay for it, or the price come out of whatever she fetches at auction.
I'm not a slave, I protested. Curf does not own me. He helped steal me from my home.
The deskman looked at me tolerantly. Spoil of war, prize of battle, you are his, whatever he chooses to call you. He can keep you as slave or ransom you back. That will be up to this curf if he comes to claim you.
He settled himself back in his chair with a sigh and took a deep drink from his cup. My tears started again. Despite how useless they were, the bored guard looked down on me.
Follow me,
he said in clear common, and when I turned and bolted for the door, he stepped forward, tripped me, and laughed. He picked me up by the back of my jerkin as if I were a sack, and carried me through the same door he'd entered from, not caring at all how he thudded me against the frame. He kicked it shut behind us, tossed me to the floor, and said,
You can follow me, or I can kick you all the way down this hallway. It's all one to me.
It was not all one to me. I stood, gave him a stiff nod, and then followed him. We went around a corner and down some stone steps. It was cooler down there, and dimmer. The only light came from some small windows at intervals in the wall. I followed him past several doors. He opened the last one and said,
Get in there.
I hesitated, and he gave me a shove and shut the door behind me. I heard it latch. The room was small, but not terrible. Light came from a very small window. It was so small that even if I could have reached it, I couldn't have wriggled out. There was a woven straw mat in one corner. In the opposite corner, there was a hole in the floor. Stains and the smell told me what it was for. Next to the mat was a ewer. It had water in it. I sniffed it to be sure it was water. I dipped the hem of my shirt into it and wiped the stupid tears from my face. Then I went and sat down on the straw mat. I sat for a long time. Then I lay down. I might have slept a bit. I heard the latch work and stood up. A man opened the door carefully, looking all around and then down at me. He seemed surprised at how small I was.
Food,
he said, and handed me a crockery bowl. I was so surprised I just stood there, clutching it as he left, closing the door behind him. When he was gone, I looked down in the bowl. It was grainy mush, with a few pieces of an orange vegetable on top of it. I carried it back to my mat and ate it carefully with my fingers. Someone had put enough for an adult in the bowl. It was the most food I'd had in a very long time. I tried to eat it very slowly and to think what I should do next. When the food was gone, I drank some water and then wiped my fingers clean on my shirt hem. The light coming into my little room was getting dimmer. I wondered if anything else would happen, but it didn't. When my cell was dark, I lay down on my mat and closed my eyes. I thought of my father. I imagined what he would have done to the guards. Or Dwalia. I imagined him throttling her and clenched my own fists and panted at how satisfying that would be. He would teach them. He would kill them all for me. But my father was not here. He could not know where I was. No one was coming to save me. I cried for a time, and then slept, clutching my mother's candle. When I woke, there was a small square of light on the floor of my little room. I used the hole in the floor and drank some more water. I waited. Nothing happened. After what seemed like a long time, I shouted and pounded on the door. Nothing happened. When I couldn't shout or pound any more, I sat on my mat. I reached for Wolffather and could not find him. It was a very bad moment. I decided he had always been something I pretended. And now I was too old, and the world was too real for me to pretend anything any more. When I need you, you are gone, just like everyone else.
When you block me out, I cannot make you hear me.
I blocked you out?
When you close your thoughts. So here we are, in a cage again. At least your captors are kind, for now.
For now?
You will be sold.
I know. What should I do?
For now, eat. Sleep. Let your body heal. When they take you out of here to sell, be very aware of me. We may yet escape.
His words gave me very little hope, but before I'd had no hope at all. I cried until I slept that night. When I woke the next morning, I felt better than I had in many days. I inspected the bruises on my legs and arms. They were yellow and pale green, fading from black and deep blue. My belly hurt less, and I could move my arm in a full circle. I combed my growing hair with my fingers and then chewed my fingernails shorter. Another guard brought me a bowl of food and filled my water ewer. He took the empty bowl away. He didn't speak to me. It was another big bowl of food. This time the mush had some stringy strands of greens cooked into it, and there was a lump of yellow vegetable on top. I ate it all, then watched the square of light move across my floor and up the wall and until it was gone. Night again. I cried again and slept again. I dreamed that my father was angry because I had not put my inks away. I woke up while it was still dark, knowing that something like that had never happened, but wishing it could. I fell back to sleep and dreamed an important dream about a swimming dragon who captured my father. I woke to the square of light and wished I could write the dream down, but there was nothing I could write on, and no ink or pen. I spent the afternoon devising a way to tie my folded candle into the hem of my underblouse so it would not be lost. That day passed. Another bowl of food. Would they auction me soon? How did they count the 3 days? Did they start the day they caught me, or the day after? I wondered who would buy me and what sort of work I'd have to do. Would I be able to convince them to send word to my father? Perhaps I'd be sold as a house slave and could convince the buyers to ransom me. I'd heard of slaves, but had no idea how they were treated. Would they beat me? Keep me in a kennel? I was still wondering those things when I heard the latch to my door rattle. A guard opened it and then stepped back.
"This one?" he asked someone, and Kerf stuck his head around the door. He stared at me dully. I almost felt glad to see him. Then I heard Dwelia's voice.
"That's the little wretch. What a trouble she has been."
"She?"
The guard was surprised.
"We thought it was a boy."
"So did we," exclaimed Vindelia. "He is my brother."
He poked his head past the doorframe and smiled at me. His cheeks were not as plump as they had been, and his sparse hair was dull, but the light of friendship was still in his eyes. I hated him. They never would have found me if he had not mastered Kerf for Dwelia. He'd betrayed me. The guard stared at him.
"Your brother! I see the resemblance," he said.
But no one laughed. I felt sick.
"I don't know those people," I said. "They're lying to you."
The guard shrugged.
"I don't really care, as long as someone settles you fine."
He swung his gaze back to Kerf.
"She got caught stealing a loaf of pollen bread. You'll have to pay for it."
Kerf nodded dully. I knew that Vindelia was controlling him, but not too well. Kerf seemed very dim, as if he had to think carefully before he could speak. Elik had always seemed very sure of himself. Was Vindelia losing his magic, or was something going wrong with Kerf? Perhaps the 2 trips through the stone had done it.
"I will pay," he said at last.
"Pay first, then you can take her. You owe for 4 days of her keep here, too."
They shut my door and walked away. I felt a twinge of gladness that they would cheat him for extra days, and then worried that perhaps I had been here 4 days and had lost track of time. I waited for them to come back, dreading that I'd be with them again, but almost relieved that someone else would be in charge of me. It seemed to take a long time, but eventually I heard the latch lift.
"Come along,"
Dwelia snapped at me.
"You are far more trouble than you are worth."
Her eyes promised a beating later, but Vindelia was smiling fatuously at me. I wished I knew why he liked me. He was my worst enemy, but also my only ally. Kerf had seemed to like me, but if Vindelia held his reins, I had no hope of help from him. Perhaps I should try to build my friendship with Vindelia. Perhaps if I had been wiser, I would have done that from the very start. Dwelia had a long coil of light cord. Before I could protest, she looped it around my neck.
"No!"
I cried, but she jerked it tight. When I reached for it, Kerf took my left hand, and she seized my right and turned it up behind my back. I felt a loop of the cord coil around my wrist. She was very quick at doing it. Doubtless she had done this before. My hand was uncomfortably high, and I could not lower it without tightening the loop around my neck. She held the end of the line in her hand. She gave it an experimental tug, and I had to jerk my head back.
"There we are," she said with great satisfaction. "No more little tricks from you. Off we go."
After the cool dimness of my cell, the bright day was painful and soon too warm for me. Kerf and Dwalia walked in front of me, my leash barely slack. I had to hurry to keep up with them. Vindalaya trotted beside me. It struck me how oddly he was made, with his bean-shaped body and short legs. I recalled how Dwalia had called him sexless. I wondered if she had castrated him, like the men did our goats when they wanted to raise them for meat, or had he been born that way? "Where is Alaria?" I asked him quietly. He gave me a miserable look.
"Sold to a slaver, for money for food and passage on a boat."
Kerf gave a twitch.
"She was mine. I wanted to take her to my mother. She would have been a good serving wench. Why did I do that?" "Vindalaya!"
Dwalia snapped. This time I opened my senses and I felt what he did to Kerf. I tried to understand it. I knew how to put up my walls to keep out my father's thoughts. I'd had to do that since I was small, just to have peace in my own mind. But it felt as if Vindalaya pushed a wall into Kerf's mind, one that kept out Kerf's thoughts and made him share what Vindalaya thought. I pushed against Vindalaya's wall. It was not that strong, but I was not sure how to breach it. Still, I heard a whisper of what he told Kerf.
"Don't worry. Go with Dwalia. Do what she wants. Don't wonder about anything. It will all be fine. Don't touch his mind. Don't break his wall."
The warning came from Wolffather.
"Listen, but don't let him feel you there."
"Why?"
"If you make a way into his thoughts, it's also a way for him to come into yours. Be very careful of touching his mind."
"Where are we going?" I asked aloud.
"Shut up,"
Dwalia said, just as Vindalaya said.
"To the boat for our journey."
I went quiet, but not because of Dwalia's order. For just a moment I had sensed that it was hard for Vindalaya to talk, trot at Dwalia's heels, and control Kerf. He was hungry, his back hurt, and he needed to relieve himself, but he knew better than to ask Dwalia to pause. As I kept my silence, I felt his focus on Kerf grow tighter and stronger. So, a distraction might weaken his control. That was a small but useful thing to know. Wolffather's voice was a bare whisper in my mind.
"Sharp claws and teeth. You learn, cub. We will live."
"Are you real?"
He did not answer, but Vindalaya cocked his head and stared at me strangely.
"Walls up. Keep him out of my mind."
I would always have to be on guard now. I tightened my guard on myself and knew that when I shut out Vindalaya, I shut out Wolffather as well.
Chapter 8. Tintaglia.
This dream was like a painting that moved. The light was dim, as if pale grey or blue paint had been washed over all. Beautiful streamers in brilliant colours moved in a slow breeze that came and went, so that the streamers rose and fell. They were shimmering pennants of gold and silver, scarlet, azure, and viridian. Bright patterns like diamonds or eyes and twining spirals ran the length of each pennant. In my dream, I moved closer, flowing effortlessly toward them. There was no sound and no feel of wind on my face. Then my perspective shifted. I saw huge snake heads, blunt-nosed, with eyes as large as melons. I came closer and closer, although I did not wish to, and finally, I could see the faint gleam of a net that held all those creatures as fish are caught in a gill net. The lines of the net were nearly transparent, and somehow I knew that they had all rushed into the net at the same moment to be trapped and drowned there. This dream had the certainty of a thing that had happened, and not just once. It would happen again and again. I could not stop it, for it was already done. Yet I also knew it would happen again.
Dream Journal of B. Farsia. Early the next morning, there was a knock on our chamber door. I rolled from the bed and then stood. The fool did not even twitch. Barefoot, I padded to the door. I paused to push my hair back from my face, and then opened it. Outside, King Rain had flung back the hood of his cloak, and it dripped water on the floor around him. Rain gleamed on his brow and was caught in droplets in his sparse beard. He grinned at me, white teeth incongruous in his finely scaled face.
"Fitzchivalry! Good tidings, and I wanted to share them right away. A bird just came in from across the river. Tarman has arrived there."
Across the river? A brandy headache had begun a sudden clangor in my head.
"At the village. It's far easier for the barge to nose in there than to dock here, and it's much better for Captain Leftrin to offload cargo there than have us ferry it across the river a bit at a time. Tarman had a full load. Workers for the farm, a dozen goats, sacks of grain, 3 dozen chickens. We hope the goats will fare better than the sheep did. The sheep were a disaster. I think only 3 survived the winter. This time we will keep the chickens penned."
He cocked his head and apologized.
"Sorry for waking you so early, but I thought you'd want to know. The ship will need cleaning before it's fit for passengers. A day, perhaps 2, 3 at worst. But soon you'll be able to depart."
"Welcome news indeed," I told him. I reached past my headache to dredge up courtesy. "Although your hospitality has been wonderful, we look forward to continuing our journey." He nodded, scattering droplets.
"There are others that I must notify. Forgive me that I must go in haste."
And off he went, dripping down the corridor. I tried to imagine Dutiful delivering such a message to a guest. I watched him go and felt a twinge of envy for how spontaneously the dragon traders seemed to interact. Perhaps I'd had it backward all along. Perhaps being a bastard had given me far more freedom than living within the rules that bound a prince. I shut the door as the fool crawled to the edge of the bed.
"What was that?"
he asked unhappily. "King Rain with news. The Tarman is docked across the river. We will depart in a day or two." He swung his legs over the edge of the bed, sat up, and then leaned forward, his head in his hands.
"You got me drunk,"
he complained. I was so tired of lying. "There are things I have to know. One way or another, fool, you need to talk to me." He moved slowly, lifting his head from his hands cautiously.
"I'm very angry with you,"
he said quietly,
"but I should have expected this."
He lowered his face back into his hands. His next words were muffled.
"Thank you."
He clambered from the bed, moving as if his brains might spill out of his skull, and spoke in Amber's voice.
"Tamara has requested my time for a visit. I think she is exceedingly curious about the silver on my hands and how it affects me. I think today I will call on her. Would you summon Spark to help me dress?"
"Of course." I noticed she did not ask me to accompany her. I supposed I deserved that. That afternoon, when the rain eased, I ventured out with Lant. I wished to see the map tower. I had first seen it many years ago when I had accidentally stumbled through a skillstone and into Kelsingrar. The fine maps that Shade and Ketrican had given me had not survived the bear attack. I hoped to refresh what I recalled with a look at that elderling map. But we had not walked far when I heard the wild trumpeting of dragons, and then the shouts of excited people.
"What is it?"
Lant asked me, and in the next breath,
"We should return to the others.
No. Those are welcoming shouts. A dragon returns, one that has been long absent. A trick of the wind had brought a name to my ears. Tintaglia returns, I told him, and I would see her again. Tintaglia, he said in hushed awe. His eyes were wide. Riddle spoke of her, the queen dragon who came to help free Icefire and then rose as his mate, she who forced Icefire to lay his head upon the hearthstones in Queen Eliania's mother house to fulfill the challenge that Eliania had set for Dutiful.
You know all that?
Fits. It's known to every child in the six duchies. Hap Gladheart sings that song about the dragons, the one that has the line, bluer than sapphires, gleaming like gold. I have to see her for myself.
I think we shall, I shouted at him, for a wild chorus of dragons trumpeting now drowned our voices. They had risen from the city in greeting or challenge. It was an astonishing sight, beauty and terror mingling equally. They cavorted like swallows before a storm, but these were creatures larger than houses. They gleamed and glittered against the cloudy sky in colors more like jewels than creatures of flesh. Then, flying over the tops of the trees in the distance, I saw Tintaglia. For a moment, I could not resolve how close she was to us. Then, as she flew nearer, I realized my error. She truly was that large. She dwarfed any of the dragons we had seen in Kelsingrar, far larger than the last time I had seen her. This queen dragon was aware of the stir she was causing in the city. She swept far wide of us in a great circle. As she spiraled round and round, I found I could scarcely take my eyes off her. My heart lifted in admiration, and I found that a grin commanded my face. I managed to glance at Lant and saw that he had clasped both his hands on his breast and was smiling up at her. Dragon glamour, I croaked out, but I still could not stop smiling. Careful, Lant, or you will burst into song.
Oh, bluer than sapphires and gleaming like gold!
And there was music in his voice and longing.
No minstrel song could do justice to her. Gold and then silver she glitters, brighter by far than jewels. Oh, Fitz, would that I never had to look away from her.
I said nothing. Tales of dragon glamour were well known now throughout the six duchies. Some never fell prey to it, but others were ensorcelled by the mere glimpse of a dragon in the distance. Lant would hear no warning from me now, but I suspected the spell would be broken as soon as she was no longer in sight. Had I not already had my skill walls raised against the clamour of Kelsingrar, it was likely I would have felt as giddy as he did. It quickly became apparent that she would land in the plaza before the greeting hall. Lant hurried, and I kept pace with him. Even so, she was on the ground before we arrived, and elderlings and lesser dragons had begun to gather. Lant tried to surge forward, but I caught his arm and held him back. Queen Malta and King Rain, I cautioned him, and their son, they will be the first to greet her. And they were. Even the dragons of Kelsingrar kept a respectful distance, something I had not expected. Tintaglia folded her wings leisurely, shaking them out twice as if to be sure that every scale was in place before gradually closing them to a chorus of admiring sighs from those who had gathered. When Rain and Malta appeared with Fron on their heels, it was obvious to me that Malta had performed hasty grooming and Rain had donned a clean tunic and smoothed his hair. Fron was grinning in awe-struck wonder, but Malta's expression was more reserved, almost stony, as she descended the steps to stand small before Tintaglia. Queen to queen, I found myself thinking, despite the size difference. Rain walked at her side, but half a step behind as the queens advanced to greet each other. Tintaglia surveyed Malta, her neck arched and her eyes slowly whirling as if she inspected her. Malta's expression did not change as she said coolly,
"So you have returned to Kelsingrar, Tintaglia. Your absence has been long this time."
"Has it?
to you, perhaps.
The dragon's trumpeting was musical, and her thoughts rode on the sound.
You must recall the dragons do not reckon time in the tiny droplets of days that seem so significant to humans. But yes, I have returned. I come to drink and to be well groomed.
As if to snub Malta for her rebuke, the dragon ignored Rain and swung her head to look down at Fron, who gazed up at her adoringly. The dragon's eyes spun fondly. She leaned down and breathed on him, and I saw his garments ripple in her hot breath. Abruptly, she flung her head up and then glared all about in indignation.
This one is mine. Who has interfered with him? What foolish dragon has dared to alter what is mine?
Who has dared to save his life, do you mean? Who has dared to set his body right so that he need not choose between breathing and eating? Is that what you ask?
Malta demanded.
Tintaglia's gaze jerked back to Malta. Colors rippled in her throat and cheeks, and the scales of her neck abruptly hackled into a series of crests. I thought Queen Malta would at least step back. Instead, she stepped forward, and this time Rain moved with her and beside her. I was astonished to see a similar flush of colouring in the crest of flesh above her brow. Malta stood, hands on her hips and her head tilted back. The patterns in the scales on her face echoed Tintaglia's in miniature. The dragon's great eyes narrowed.
Who?
She demanded again. Ice crept up my spine, and I held my breath. No one spoke. Wind wandered among us, adding to the chill, ruffling hair and reddening noses.
I thought you might be pleased to see I was still alive, for without the changes wrought in me, I doubt I would be.
Fron stepped forward to stand between his parents and the dragon. Malta's hand reached out to snatch him back to safety, but Rain put his hand on top of her wrist. Slowly, he pushed her arm down and then caught her hand in his. He said something, and I saw a flicker of agony cross Malta's face. Then she stood silent as her son faced down the dragon that had shaped all of them. Tintaglia was silent. Would she admit that she cared if he lived or died? But she was a dragon.
Who?
She demanded a third time, and the colors on her throat flared brighter. No one replied, and she set the end of her muzzle against Fron's chest and pushed him. He staggered back, but did not fall. It was enough. Stand well clear of me, I told Lent. I took three steps into the open space that surrounded the dragon. My walls were up tight. I lifted my voice into a shout.
Tintaglia! Here I stand.
Faster than a serpent strikes, her head whipped around and her gaze fixed on me. I could almost feel the pressure of that scrutiny as she said,
And who are you? Who dares use my name?
You know me. I controlled my voice but pitched it to carry. Fron had glanced at his parents, but he had not retreated to shelter behind them. Tintaglia snorted. She shifted so she faced me. The wind of her breath was meaty and rich.
Few are the humans I know, little gnat. I do not know you.
But you do. It was years ago. You wished to know where the black dragon was. You hunted me through my dreams. You wanted Icefire freed from his prison. I am the one who did what you could not. I broke the glacier and released him from both ice and the pale woman's torment. So you know me, dragon, as you know my daughter, Nettle, and as you know me, so also you owe me. There was a collective gasp at my words.
From the corner of my eye, I saw Lady Amber emerge onto the steps, with Spark and Purr flanking her. I prayed she would not interfere, that she would keep the youngsters safely out of the dragon's knowing. Tintaglia stared at me, her eyes whirling gold and silver, and I felt the pressure of her mind against mine. For one instant, I yielded my walls to her. I showed her nettle in her dreamed gown of butterfly wings. Then I slammed the gates of my mind, shutting her out and desperately hoping my walls could hold.
Ha!
Tintaglia made the simple word a curse.
Not a gnat, that one. A gadfly. A biting, buzzing, blood-sucking.
I'd never seen such a large creature strangling on words. I felt a sudden rush of pride in Nettle. She had used her skill and her dream manipulation to strike back at the dragon, turning the creature's own weapons against her. With no formal training in the Farseer magic, Nettle had not only bent Tintaglia to her purpose, but also persuaded that strong-willed queen to make Icefire honor Prince Dutiful's promise to lay the black dragon's head on the bricks of Eliania's hearthfire. Icefire's entry into the Narcheska's mother house had caused some damage to the door lintel, but the promise had been fulfilled and Dutiful had won his bride. And a dragon remembered my daughter. For one exhilarating moment, my heart teetered on exultation, as close to immortality as any human could come. Tintaglia advanced on me. Colors swept over her like flames consuming wood.
You interfered with my elderlings. That offends me, and I owe you nothing. Dragons have no debts.
I said the words before I considered them. Dragons have debts. They simply don't pay them. Tintaglia settled back on her haunches, lifted her head high, and tucked in her chin. Her eyes spun fast, the colors flickering, and I more felt than saw how both humans and dragons retreated from her.
Fitz,
Lant whispered harshly, a plea.
Get back. Stay back, I whispered.
I was going to die. Die or live horribly maimed. I'd seen what the acid spew of a dragon did to men and to stone. I steeled myself. If I ran, if I took shelter behind the others, they would die with me. A gust of wind struck me, and then, as lightly as a crow hopping to a halt, a much smaller scarlet dragon alighted between me and death. An instant later, I felt a sudden weight on my shoulder, and...
Fitz?
Motley greeted me.
Hello, stupid,
she added. The scarlet dragon folded her wings as if it were an important task that must be done in a very particular way. I thought Tintaglia would spray the creature with acid in vengeance for her interrupted fury. Instead, it appeared that she regarded the red dragon in perplexity.
Hebe?
The crow said to me.
Hebe, Hebe?
Motley turned and suddenly gave my ear a vicious peck.
Hebe!
The bird insisted.
Hebe,
I repeated to calm her. General Rapscal's dragon. My acknowledgement placated her.
Hebe, good hunter. Lots of meat.
The crow chuckled happily. Lant seized my arm.
Come away, you fool,
he hissed at me.
While she is distracted by the red dragon, get out of her sight. She means to kill you.
But I moved only to shrug off his grip. The much smaller scarlet dragon was facing off with the immense blue one. Hebe's head wove on her serpentine neck. Every imaginable shade of red flushed over her. There was no mistaking the challenge in her stance. I felt the tension of the communication between them, though I could not mine any sense of human words from the low rumbling of the red.
It was like a pressure in the air, a flow of thoughts I could feel, but not share. Tintaglia's crest and the row of erect scaling on her neck.